This is The End User, episode 175 for Thursday, June 19th. iPad App Spaghetti. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr.
And Taylor, we took a little bit of a break on Monday so that we could watch the United States play in the World Cup. And I'm glad to report to the listeners that they, in fact, triumphed over Ghana. So that's good to see.
Yes, very good to see, considering their World Cup history as a match. And I was watching as well. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, how did you end up watching it?
On a laptop on a bad Wi-Fi connection.
Oh, yeah. So you were doing ESPN3 as well. I did the same thing. Cool. Well, let's get into this week's tech news. We've got some interesting announcement from Amazon. They're going to be shipping a phone. So this is not something they've done before. We've seen their tablet offering. They called that the Kindle Fire. And what they're calling the phone is... they're also calling the phone Fire. So it's the Amazon Fire Phone.
The Fire Phone.
Yeah, I guess they've got some alliteration there. That's good.
Yeah, and so it wasn't much of a leap to assume that they would take their Kindle Fire tablets and Fire OS and bring that to a phone. But the question is, how well could they do it? Could they offer something that people would want that's at a competitive price? And I'd say hardware-wise, they really knocked it out of the park. They made a really nice phone with a 4.7-inch screen. And, the interesting thing is that they put six cameras on there.
Yeah, and that's a 720p display, we should mention.
Right, so a 315 pixels per inch screen density, a little bit lower than the iPhone.
Yeah, and that's enough, right? I mean, it could have...
Yeah, it's right around that Retina pixel limit. It's right at the edge of it. So it's a pretty nice screen.
Yeah, it could have been a little bit better. But I think, honestly, you know, at 720p, that's pretty good. I think we can say that is pretty much all the screen you need. I mean, you could get a little bit better, but it's right up there. So what's up with six cameras? Why six cameras?
Well, I guess four of them are on the front, and they're there just to track your head as you're looking at the phone.
So Amazon is going to be tracking my head all the time.
All the time.
Yeah, that sounds like a privacy concern, but, you know, I don't know. I don't read that much into it. I can't imagine they would do anything nefarious with this stuff. But, yeah, so they're calling this feature dynamic perspective, and what that kind of means is that in their applications, you can tilt the phone around to get this kind of parallax shifting view. So, for example, if you were playing a game, you could tilt the phone sideways and peek around the corner of like a shooting game or something like that. So you can kind of look into things as if there was this 3D aspect to the phone, even though it's not really 3D. It's kind of an illusion.
But Chris, I have parallax on my iPhone as well.
No, this is a little different. This is like you tilt the phone a little bit and you can it'll manipulate the image in a way that it makes it feel as if you are going around the corner in a 3D way. But it's only a little bit of 3D. It's not the, you know, we need glasses now, HTC Evo kind of 3D.
I don't know. It sounds an awful lot like what I have on iOS 7.
Well, at any rate, I think that is kind of a gimmick, and I'm not sure that is going to make anyone want anything. And not to mention that I bet the only places where this thing is going to be implemented is in the Amazon apps. I'm not sure they're opening this up to third-party developers. And even if you were a third-party developer, would you really want to develop to some Amazon API on Android instead of just programming to the regular old Android API? I would be suspicious of developing for this if it were open. But I guess that's kind of the point, is that this is an integrated device. This is the Amazon experience. This has nothing to do with stock Google Android. And that's kind of the device they've built. So, you know, they've got a very large app store at this point in time, but I'm still a little skeptical of the kind of integrated Amazon experience and ditching all of the niceties of the Google part of the phone.
Yeah, it is kind of a hard sell. You're buying into a different ecosystem. You have to, I guess, if you already get a lot of your content through Amazon and maybe you have a Kindle or a Kindle Fire already, you know, it might make sense to get the Fire Phone. I could imagine that they will have some great content integration, you know.
Yes, absolutely.
Your Amazon Prime account should work for TV shows and movies to be able to watch them right there. All your books will already be on the device, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I guess that's what everyone seems to be saying is, just like with the Kindle Fire, you say, well, if you're an Amazon kind of person, then maybe this is the phone for you. But I just don't see, I don't see those people out there. I mean, there are certainly Amazon people, but I could just never recommend this to somebody, even if they are an Amazon kind of person. You know, I'm an Amazon kind of person, and this doesn't really interest me. I am more interested in the kind of stock Google experience. So I don't know. I think it's a, clearly the Kindle Fire has been successful enough that they're going forward with this, but I'm still a little skeptical of the general idea.
Yeah, I'd say I am as well. But it still looks pretty nice.
It does. And, it does.
We haven't even covered all the features yet.
Yeah, and I don't mean to take away from what it is, because just kind of in a vacuum as a standalone device, it's pretty compelling. You know, it's modern hardware, and they've got a couple features that are kind of interesting. And that dynamic perspective is just kind of a gimmicky one, and I'm not sure that'll end up going anywhere. But let's talk about the next one on the list. We've got Firefly. So they are reimagining the space cowboy show Firefly, and they're not going to release it on Fox this time.
Yeah, no, it's not quite that, although I certainly wish.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing?
It would be, yes.
Oh, that would be great. Anyway,
if Amazon's latest phone feature was just the resurrection of the cult Joss Whedon show.
That would be amazing. Yes, I'd be all over that. So this is, in fact, not that. What it is it's basically a Shazam-like app that kind of aims to identify anything and everything, presumably for your buying on Amazon. So this thing can take pictures, it can listen to music, and it will pull up whatever that thing you'd like to identify on your phone. So that seems kind of cool.
Yeah, Shazam for everything. I like it. I like the sound of it.
Yeah. So that's pretty much it. There's not a whole lot to say. It's pretty interesting technology to kind of weave together all the different kinds of identification technologies. And it kind of makes sense for Amazon's business. So I think that's a pretty big win for them. That's a cool feature.
So what can and can't it do? Obviously, it's aimed at helping people discover things that Amazon sells.
Yeah, so as far as I can see, you can take a picture of anything, and it will make an attempt. We don't know yet how good that is at identifying like objects. Presumably, you can at least point it at QR codes and barcodes and that kind of thing. That's the easy part. But they're saying that you can scan anything. So you could be in a store and there could be a product with no barcode whatsoever on it, and you could take a picture of it and it would identify it and pull it up on Amazon if it were available.
That is a pretty cool trick.
Yeah. So again, we'll have to kind of see how it actually works in the real world. But it's a pretty cool little feature. Oh, and then we do know that it can do music.
Right. The most interesting feature to me here is that although it's aimed at pointing you towards stuff in the Amazon store, they are actually releasing an API for this as well for developers to use.
Oh,
and
neat.
It's pretty full featured from what I've seen of it so far. And so you can use this technology to help identify anything. And it has a number of different little ways that it can identify certain objects, like it'll compare different pictures in order to get a full 3D view of the object that you're identifying.
Yeah. So that seems pretty neat. Again, I'm not sure as a developer looking at this, I would be terribly interested for developing only for the Amazon market, as it were. I'm not sure that's terribly interesting. But they released it, so we'll see if it takes off. So the next little bit of functionality is the Mayday button is there. We know the Mayday button from the Kindle Fire. It basically pulls up a little video chat with a Amazon or an AT&T employee in this case, and they, you know, can help you and draw on the screen and show you what's going on. It's just a support feature. So that's kind of cool to see that come along. So I think I've buried the lead here. We should mention that this is a AT&T in the United States exclusive at this point in time.
Well, it won't even be available until July 25th.
Right. So really just around the corner, about a month from now.
And it'll be $199 on contract for a 32-gigabyte phone, or an extra $100 for another 32 gigabytes for a total of 64.
Yeah, and the other thing we can talk a little bit about is they're kind of the UI of the phone. You know, we have some in the blog posts that we're sharing, we've got a bunch of screenshots of how the phone kind of gets around. And, you know, it's the same thing we see with the Fire. The Kindle Fire is, it's just kind of Amazon's unique take on Android. And it's really pretty close to Android, but they've made a lot of customizations. So there's one thing that kind of caught my eye, that if you swipe to the left to bring out the rightmost menu, you know, the so-called hamburger menu that we always talk about, there's kind of this just agenda of stuff. So there's the current weather, there's you know, your calendar appointments and some recent messages. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, it's totally cool. It's reminds me kind of like the notification center in OS X now. Yeah, I like the way that this one looks.
Yeah, so that looks pretty pretty decent. So we'll see how it does. You know, I'm not sure. Again, I'm skeptical of the whole kind of Fire platform. But I, like you said, for some people, if you're really into Amazon, I guess then these are pretty interesting to you. It's almost a shame, because I feel like if they had just done some stock Android device that, and then offer just pre-installed Android applications, I feel like I would have a different tone about this device.
Yeah, but they were never going to do that. I don't see that as being a real possibility.
Yeah, I don't think so either. It's not really its reason for being, is it?
Nope.
All right, well, let's stick on the Amazon bent, and let's talk a little bit about Amazon's new music streaming service. So this seems pretty neat. I haven't gotten a chance to try this, although I do have Amazon Prime, so I will be able to access it. So this is a competitor for Spotify and Pandora and all of the, and the Apple one. It's a competitor for all of those, and you're going to be able to stream their entire catalog off of their website. And what's kind of cool is it's streaming music with no advertisements, so they're not like Pandora. Pandora gives you ads, and Spotify does not give you ads. And the killer feature of this thing is that you are able to download tracks from the Amazon Music service, so that seems pretty neat. So it comes along with your Amazon Prime subscription, and I think it looks like a pretty compelling service. If you have Prime, you almost might as well just use it. You don't need anything else.
Yeah, this makes a lot of sense for anybody with Amazon Prime. This can easily give them another option to play music on demand besides their library. If you have Amazon Prime and you're also paying for Spotify, you sort of are paying double now. I mean, you might as well just use what Amazon has.
Yeah. Yeah. I still wish that they would split it apart, you know, and charge for the various services instead of just having it all under Amazon Prime. But, I'm not running the company, so I can't make those decisions. So they're launching right now with an iOS app, a Mac desktop app, an Android app, and a Windows app. So they've got a catalog of about 1 million songs, which is about the same as Pandora and is hugely smaller than Spotify's catalog. And Spotify's catalog is about 20 million. So I didn't know it was quite that big, actually.
Yeah, neither did I. That's a very impressive catalog, but I'm sure that Amazon's catalog will be growing over some time.
Yeah, it'll get there, and I've seen some complaints of people who have been using it about the selection not being available, and there's some notion of the new albums being delayed for some amount of time, and that can be somewhat frustrating.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, so, you know, it's the first stab at it. You know, I hope they improve it over time, and we'll see where they end up. So last bit here, if it's kind of an interesting tidbit, is that if you have downloaded a bunch of tracks and then your Prime subscription lapses, those tracks will, in fact, no longer work for you.
Ugh.
It's kind of a weird reality of the, like, mashup of subscription and downloadable content. It's a little weird, isn't it?
It is very weird.
Yeah,
I wonder what the licensing agreement that caused that to exist.
Yeah, like. I don't know. And, you know, that points me to, well, okay, these are DRM tracks then. You know, I thought at least on MP3s we had done away with DRM for a while now. But this is a slight return. But, I get it. The ability to download the tracks and have the subscription, it just kind of makes sense that this would be the case.
Yeah, you know, I guess it does. And Spotify works the same way, so there's no reason that this should be any cause for alarm. It's just, it's a little bit disappointing.
Yeah. Well, I guess the point being is that you could just sign up for a month and download the entire catalog or something and then walk away with all the free tracks. I mean, they can't allow that.
I don't see why not, Chris.
Well, at least then the... So I would start my own company and offer the same catalog just from downloading it. I would
exactly.
I would fork Amazon's music collection.
It's brilliant. I love it. Let's do it.
All right, so more news on that next week when Taylor and I start a company and steal unabashedly from Amazon. Good. I'm sure the labels won't be upset.
No, it's promotion for them.
All right, so I wanted to move into the tail end of the E3 conference. We mentioned last week all of the kind of Xbox and Microsoft-specific news. And we had also, during the last recording, they were talking about the PlayStation event while we were recording last week. So I wanted to follow up a little bit on that and talk about some games that are for the PlayStation that they were unveiling at E3. So again, neither of us are huge gamers, so we're not going to go into a lot of detail. There are a lot better sources you could go to for gaming news than us, but we'll kind of hit the highlights here. My favorite one that I saw was called The Order 1886, and this is a third-person shooter in 1886 London. It's during the Second Industrial Revolution, and it's a kind of third-person shooter like Splinter Cell with this kind of supernatural kind of bent. So that seems pretty cool. Again, we've got a link in the show notes if you want to see some screenshots and stuff like that of the games we're talking about.
Cool. So that one sounds pretty fun.
Yeah, I think that was my favorite of the lot that we're going to talk about. So the next one is Little Big Planet 3. It's basically more of the same that you would expect from the Little Big Planet.
I love that game, but I had no idea there was even a second one.
Yeah, it's an amazing game, and just to get more of it and get better graphics and have it be supported on the next generation PlayStation is definitely a good thing.
Absolutely.
So next one up is the game called Drive Club, and it's your typical kind of Need for Speed style racing game. It's, you know, street cars racing, and from what I can see, the graphics look pretty amazing. This is a 1080p, 30 frames per second game, and it just looks pretty amazing. I'm not sure it can hold a candle to Forza or some of the other ones, but it looks pretty great.
If you're making a racing sim game for a modern console right now, it has to look amazing. It has to be, yeah. It has to blow you out of the water amazing.
Yeah, you almost can't even compare all of them because they all look so great, you know. Just the raw capability of the new generation of consoles is pretty amazing.
Yep.
So last one here, and this is called Helldivers, and it's a top-down shooter, meaning that you are kind of viewing the world from above and you're controlling a character on the ground. And you kind of wander through this this generated map and you get to kill aliens. What's not to love?
Sounds good to me.
So, again, there's a lot more detail if you follow through into the show notes. We've got a link. But the one thing that made this game look kind of interesting is that in some situations, to switch weapons, you actually have to do a key combo to get to the weapon.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I feel like it...
Why would they add that extra level of complexity?
Yeah, well, you just add a little bit of friction to get to some resource that is required, and out of that comes a whole little micro game, right? You know, to get to a weapon, you have to anticipate the need for the weapon, and then hit the combo to take out the weapon, and then use it. So in multiplayer games, this kind of adds this little bit of friction that I think could make the game really, really interesting.
Well, when you put it that way.
I still think my favorite game of all time was Guns. You remember this? Did you ever play it?
No.
And it was kind of like that. To do just about anything in the game, you had to do a key combo. And the game was so poorly written that you could just glitch it. And the whole game that emerged out of that was a game that became about the glitches. The glitches were the moves that you could perform. So I see a little tinge of that in there.
Huh. I don't remember that game at all, but it sounds more fun than this one.
Yeah, it was never a very big game, I think. All right, well, that'll do it for wrapping up the E3 news. And I suppose we should turn on our afterburner. So Taylor, if you are ready and your seatbelt is securely fastened, then we can get going.
Okay, sure. Seatbelts fastened, so I will start it. Twitter has made an announcement that you can now post GIFs. Are you going to say, are you going to correct me, Chris?
Yes.
You can now post GIFs on Twitter.com and on the Android and iPhone app.
And in other news, in case you don't know what GIFs are, you can now post GIFs on Twitter using the iOS and Android apps.
The creator says it's pronounced GIF.
I don't know. It's in my brain. It's too late. It's too late for that.
Okay. Apple has announced a new model of iMac, but don't get excited unless you're looking for a really cheap iMac. So they have launched one. It's a 1.4 gigahertz, 21.5-inch iMac model with 8 gigs of RAM, not expandable, at $1,099. This is basically the motherboard from the entry-level MacBook Pro inside the case of a 21.5-inch iMac, the new tapered one with no CD drive. So it's a nice little entry-level iMac, but if you have any more money to spend on an Apple desktop, I would definitely recommend springing for the Fusion Drive in this one, or just adding an extra $100 to get to the quad-core Intel i5 version.
Yeah, but I think it's kind of nice to see them expand the bottom of the iMac line a little bit. That's good to see.
Yeah, sure.
So Facebook has introduced a new app, and they're calling it Slingshot, and it's basically a Snapchat clone. So it looks very, very similar to Snapchat, and it adds a couple kind of Facebook-specific things that you can do, but it's basically the same kind of app. You know, you can snap a photo and you can draw on it or whatever and send it to people. And then there's the whole, if you need to chat back to that person, you also need to take a picture. And it's kind of an interesting app. But again, it's just really similar to Snapchat. It's puzzling to me why they would put the resources into kind of cloning Snapchat so closely.
I guess they really want people to use their stuff instead. I mean, that's what they were doing with Instagram before they bought Instagram. So
Nest has brought back its Nest Protect smart smoke alarm. It's now $99. If you remember, they took it off the market just to be conservative because there was some concern that waving your arms in the air like a Muppet when there is a fire would actually turn the smoke alarm off, because that was the feature they had programmed in there, is you would wave your arms at the device and it would turn off. So they've disabled that feature in case you are a Muppet.
I really do like this feature, and so I'm sad that it remains disabled. I had never thought of it being such a Muppet-specific problem.
I'm not sure anyone in the real world actually does that. You know, waves their arms in the air and flails as they run out the door screaming because there's fire. I'm just not sure that actually happens.
Well, you never know. Maybe there's a stronger market for Muppets buying nests than you think.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, when safety's in the game, then if there is even a remote possibility that that would happen, then you need to remove it. And they did that. So it's actually
good. Oh, absolutely.
To see.
And they did the right thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Very good to see. And it's great that they are able to bring this product back after spending a little bit of time to ascertain that they won't be a problem for anyone well disabled, and hopefully they can bring it back in a future soft update, as they promised.
So Netflix is shutting down its public API. You know, this is the API that has brought us some third-party Netflix apps over the years. And in some ways, it's what kind of opened them up as a platform in their early days. And, you know, this is a trend we're seeing in technology companies in general, is you kind of start with this open approach, perhaps naively, and then eventually you shut down your public API once everybody has made your platform popular. So, in fact, Netflix is doing that. November 14th is when they're going to shut it down, so they've got some advance notice. Now, a silver lining here is that select partners of Netflix are still going to be able to exist. So a lot of the apps that you know are still going to exist. They basically chose the larger of all of the apps that use the public API, and they're going to continue to work with those. So the list of partners is Instant Watcher, Fanhattan, Yidio, NextGuide, Flixster, Can I Stream It, FeedFlix, Instant Watch Browser for Netflix. Those are the current partners that we know of that will be able to use the API. Every other third-party Netflix app will have to do something else after November 14th.
I'm glad to see Fanhattan on there. They actually were not supported for a while, and so this is a bit of a reversal for that company's fortunes.
Yeah, and the one that pops out at me is Can I Stream It? That's such a great service.
What does that one do?
So it aggregates all of the streaming websites, and you can type something in, and it'll tell you it's available on Apple over there, it's available on Netflix, it's available on Hulu, and it's not available on Amazon or whatever, you know.
Oh, yeah, Fanhattan does the same thing.
Yeah. But Can I Stream It is the one that I use, so I'm glad to see it in there.
Okay, I guess Fanhattan's the one I use.
All right, well, let's turn off the afterburners. Let's get into the end user stories, and let's start off with a little bit of Apple / Adobe news.
Yeah, so they are kicking off a whole bunch of new programs for iPhone, iPad, and Android. So they are launching an iPhone companion to Lightroom for basic image editing, and then an iPad app called Photoshop Mix, which will be part of their subscription-based creative suite. So you can get the app for free along with your subscription that is anywhere from $10 to $70 a month.
So what's a little confusing, it's just there's so many apps, and this seems to be a trend we've been seeing recently. This now marks three Adobe Photoshop apps for various mobile platforms, and we'll get to this later. Two hardware devices.
Right. It is a lot. And I was confused because I already had Adobe Photoshop Express on my iPhone. And it seemed like that's where they were going with this. They were going to support that. And they are still supporting Photoshop Express. I guess they're just adding more apps.
Yeah, they're just kind of adding on top of it. So the first one we'll talk about a little bit is the Lightroom for iPhone. So basically there's a desktop application called Lightroom that you can use on a Mac. And this is, like you said, it's a companion app for that Mac application. Again, it's very confusing how all of these apps kind of interplay together. So the second one is Mix, and that's kind of aimed to be the iPad Photoshop app, right?
Right, that's what it seems like to me.
And then finally, confusingly, there's still the Photoshop app that was previously in the App Store. It's still there. So I'm not sure if they're going to remove it in terms of the Photoshop Mix now being available, or if they're going to leave it there, or I'm not sure what they're going to do with that.
Well, I think Photoshop Express was a non-subscription version. It's their free to freemium model.
Right, yeah.
Because they have in-app purchases, but it's a free download and it doesn't require a Photoshop Creative Suite subscription. So I think they're probably going to keep both of them.
And to further the confusion, there's actually two more apps, but these are a little bit more purpose-driven. So these having these apps be separate kind of makes sense to me. So let's talk about the hardware up front. They released two devices that are kind of interesting called the Ink and Slide. And what it is it's a iPad pressure-sensitive pen that also comes with an accompanying device that's just kind of like a ruler. So you put this thing down on the screen, and it allows you to trace along the side of it, but it snaps the ink on the screen to the side of the slide. So you don't actually have to track with the physical piece of metal on the screen. It just kind of locks your pen into a straight line. I thought that's pretty cool.
Yes, I thought it was pretty cool as well, although I would not have understood it just from your description. no offense, but it's very strange that Adobe is launching hardware just for this. I'm not sure I understand what they're going for here. And maybe I need to use it to understand.
Yeah, that's probably true. So they've got two versions of apps for these hardware devices. And one's called Sketch and one's called Line. And I was very confused what the difference was until I read two key words. One is bitmapped and one is vector. So one is like Photoshop and one is like Illustrator. And that pretty much makes it clear to me that one is for kind of editing images together and one is for making line-drawn art. So those are, in fact, two different purposes. So I don't know. You think Adobe is just kind of throwing all this stuff out here to see what kind of sticks, what's popular, what's not? You know, we're in a new era of tablet applications, and maybe they're just trying to figure it out as they go along.
Yeah, I feel like I'm getting some Samsung sensibilities from them.
Yeah. There's
definitely, they are cooking pasta, and they're throwing out to see what sticks.
Yes. Adobe's making iPad pasta.
Wow, we are just competing for show titles tonight, aren't we?
All right, well, let's move on to our last story in the end user stories. I've got an interesting link, and it is way too long to talk about in completeness. This is an article that has 26 pages of content. This is longer than some short stories, I'm sure. But what it is a chronicle of kind of the history of Android. In fact, that's the title. It's The History of Android. It's on Ars Technica. And they go through screenshots of the Android UI from the first version up until the most recent version. And I think it's kind of interesting to see how all of this stuff has evolved over time and, you know, what elements have stayed there from the very beginning. And I don't know, I just think it's kind of a cool look back on the current life of Android.
Yeah, it's absolutely cool. And I really enjoyed it as long as this article was. There's a lot of interesting information there.
And I would love to see the same thing, but for iOS. That would be cool, too.
Yeah, I could go for that. Just the design language of Android sort of shows how smartphones have changed and how we think of them has changed.
That's absolutely true. I mean, you look at some of these screenshots, and you definitely go from the early days of not really understanding touchscreen navigation to some of the later days where we're starting to get our hands on touchscreen technology and how it's supposed to work. And then even the very last screenshot is showcasing this kind of flat metro design. So it's almost like a portfolio through the years of different design styles and different user experience paradigms. And, you know, there's maybe three kind of shifts that they have gone through. And I think it just mirrors the design sense of the kind of design industry at large. You know, it's not just Android. It's, you can see other bits of design creep their way into Android, and you can see it influence other bits of design.
Yeah, well put, Chris.
Well, so anyway, to get the full effect of that one, you're going to have to open up the link in the show notes there and poke around in that really, really earth-shatteringly long article.
And to get the full effect out of your Android camera using Google's new camera app, you should check out our tip of the week. Anyway, which is basically just a guide by Lifehacker that takes you through all of the new settings in the new Google camera app. I don't have an Android phone, so I haven't tried this, but it's a big improvement over the old camera app. A lot of people were using third-party camera apps for their Android phones. And so there's a lot of cool new features here that are worth checking out that you couldn't get to in certain cameras before, or that you had to get third-party software to get to.
Cool, yeah. So there's a bunch of good stuff in there. All right, well, shall we move into our app pick of the week?
Sure, yeah. Let's do that.
All right, so I've got this one covered this week. Garmin has released a GPS app for iOS and Android, and I thought that this was a pretty neat way to go. They're calling it Viago, and basically it's Garmin software on your phone. What could go wrong with that, right? I mean, they're one of the best software makers for GPS devices, and bringing their software to the phone is only a win. Now, it is a little bit expensive, as you might expect.
Yeah, I always remember that being the problem.
Yes.
Those apps, they are expensive, but it's worth it if you get what, you know, if you get a premium service out of it, if you get what you pay for.
So for 99 cents, at least until July 13th, when it goes up to $1.99, you get kind of a limited functioning GPS application. So what they've done is they've implemented the in-app purchases, and you can buy a bunch of other features as you go if you find that you need them. So that's $9.99 for live traffic until July 13th, when it goes up to $20 or $19.99. They've got some active lane guidance, which is pretty cool. They call that Safety Kit, and that's an extra $9.99. And they've got the turn-by-turn feature that is not turned on until you give them another $9.99. So altogether, that is quite a bit of money for a single application.
It is. It's a lot of money. But it's nice that they give you the features each for relatively cheap. I mean, some people may not necessarily need the landmark-based directions or the stuff like active lane guidance and current speed. But live traffic for $20, when you can get that for free on almost every other GPS app, is kind of crazy.
Yeah, I think it's hard for them because they're entering a market where everybody is making a mapping app, but it's not their core business, right? So they're in a position where they have to charge for this stuff, and it's really their core business. This is where they make money. And all of the other companies who are doing this are doing it as kind of a side business where, you know, Google, for example, they get all of the they get all of their mapping data together, and it's a huge effort for them, but as long as you use Google services, they kind of make money off of you because you're using Google services. But they are kind of a mapping company and a software company, and it's really their core competency. So unfortunately, I think they need to charge a little bit more, and I'm not sure they're ever going to compete with the likes of Google Maps and Nokia Maps. And I guess, you know, you look out there and Waze is competing a little bit better than that, and it's also their core competency. But I don't know. It's kind of an interesting play, and I think it's way too expensive. I can't imagine they're going to sell a lot of these extra features, at least, at $10 each.
No, they're probably not. You're right. But maybe that's not really the point. Maybe the point is just to get people to keep using Garmin.
Yeah, maybe it's just their core competency is, in fact, not a software application on these platforms. It's the hardware. Maybe that's what they're kind of after, and they're just trying to kind of stay relevant, maybe.
We can't know exactly what they're thinking.
Yeah, so...
But they do seem to have made a pretty good app here.
Yeah.
It's reasonable to get into it. You can try out the features that you know you might want that you aren't getting from Google Maps or Apple Maps or Bing or whatever it is that you're using already.
Yeah, another player in the game just means more competition, so that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, let's move on to our last story of the week, our so-called kicker, and we've got an interesting one here. Taylor, have you heard of Dogecoin?
Yes, I have heard of Dogecoin. It's always quite hilarious to me, especially now that Bitcoin appears to be in a little bit of trouble. Dogecoin is doing quite well.
Yeah, somehow it just kind of took off. It seems to have really gained market traction in the cryptocurrency world, oddly enough. So the interesting bit here that we're sharing is that there was somebody, and we don't know who was able to install malware on some network storage devices and was able to use a conglomeration of these things to mine about $620,000 worth of Dogecoin. Clearly, illegally, from using other people's devices. So that is the biggest mining heist I've ever seen in the cryptocurrency world.
Yeah, I didn't even know that there could be mining heists. But I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, I saw there was another one where somebody was using people's browsers to mine for Bitcoin. So you would visit a site, and they would temporarily just take over your browser in JavaScript or whatever, and they would use your browser as a way to mine for Bitcoin. So,
right. I did hear about that, yeah.
There's definitely ways you can kind of abuse the system by using other people's devices, because, you know, the whole point is that you need to throw processing power at the thing to mine for these crypto coins. And in this case, you've got a bunch of network attacked storage that has a bunch of power sitting around, probably not doing a whole lot most of the time. And this, whoever this was able to use a whole network of these things to be very effective at mining.
So there doesn't seem to be anything specific about the cryptography of Dogecoin that would suggest only Dogecoin was vulnerable to this attack. So do you think we're going to start seeing the same attack on other forms of cryptocurrency?
Well, yeah. I mean, it applies to all cryptocurrencies, right? Just because if you are able to build a machine that has more processing capabilities, then you can mine more crypto coin, whatever flavor it is.
Yeah.
So the kind of distributed malware Bitcoin mining operation, I definitely think we're going to see more of that. I'm not sure I'd call it an attack, but basically somebody exploited something in a bunch of network devices and then used them to his advantage to mine Bitcoin in a highly distributed fashion.
But do you think that we will see this same vulnerability attacked in other forms of cryptocurrency?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's very likely. I mean, the platform is ripe for this, right?
Yeah, it seems to be.
So, and now that the cat's out of the bag and somebody has done this successfully, I can't imagine that we wouldn't see other people doing it in different kind of platforms as well. You know, not just network attack storage devices, but, you know, in Android apps and stuff like that, you know, just kind of casually mining for Bitcoin as their users use them, and people won't really notice other than the fact that it kills your battery, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it's definitely going to become a bigger concern, but things are not looking good for cryptocurrencies in general this week.
Yeah. Well, at any rate, one person is rich and happy, and I guess all of the other people mining Dogecoin are not.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the Shiba Inu himself. I was like, oh, yes, very rich and happy.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other story for another time, perhaps. All right, well, it's time to get out of here. I think if we should give our contact information. If, Taylor, if somebody were to try to contact you on the internet in some way, how would they go about doing this?
I would suggest that they send me Dogecoin.
Okay, and your Dogecoin address is?
Well, I guess you'd have to me on Twitter to get my Dogecoin address. So you can do that on Twitter. I am at TaylorPhone. Or if you want to hear me talk about food, you can check out my new Twitter account, at TaylorFood.
Yeah, I remember you had an old Twitter account about sandwiches. So this is the new food account for you. That's cool.
Yeah, the sandwiches one was a little too specific. I didn't find myself with enough news to post. So I decided to go a little bit more broad and just talk about food in general.
Cool. So if you want to get at me, my Twitter handle is at Chris Hale Barnes. I do not have a Dogecoin address, so don't try. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The Digital Media Zone has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, The Movie Podcast, and, of course, Home On. You can also send us some feedback. We've got an email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. We are at @theenduser. Join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mott.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.